Welcome back to Plot Pit, the show where we forge fiction from fact and folklore. William Atkinson here with
John LeMay.
And on the phone, we have best-selling author Justina Luther, author of BioLife and many more. Hello, Justina. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing very well. I'm so happy to be here. This is so much fun.
And we had a blast in the last episode. Today, we're talking more about your book, BioLife, and many more other works that you've worked on. Yeah, totally tripped up on verbiage there. I apologize, folks. So let's begin the descent. Justina, why don't you give us a little brief understanding of BioLife, and then we'll get into what inspired you to write that.
Okay, so BioLife. What would you do if you awoke covered in scars with no memory of where they came from? This hypothetical is a reality for me and six other people. Each of us were left for dead in the middle of nowhere with only one thought in mind: get to safety. We have no idea why we all had the same thought or what happened to us, but if it takes my last breath, we will.
What inspired you?
So, as many of my books do, it literally started with an image that just popped into my head. And I wish I could tell you what the image was, but it actually ended up not making it into book one. And it will be in book two, which I am currently working on.
Oh, so there's a sequel. This will be fun.
I've got the sequel. The first book is BioLife. The sequel is going to be Afterlife. And there's possibly a third one, depending on how Afterlife ends.
So you haven't written the ending or have it in mind yet?
I have it in mind, but I need to see how many threads I can put in book two that I can pull for book three.
I know this sounds so, so very, very silly, but orange juice. In the first few pages of BioLife, you've got this scene with the elder gentleman and then the girl, and orange juice pops up. And in my head, I remember juice as being like the soda alternative growing up in the 80s and the 90s. And it was, you know, the sweet treat and everything else that your parents thought was healthy. And in general, it's probably still healthier than your corn syrup based sodas. But is there a particular reason why orange juice in that opening sequence?
Well, the scene that I believe you're referring to is between Jameson Hughes, his daughter, and his brother, Alexander Hughes. And basically, without giving too much away, Jameson and Alexander are trying to get Jameson's daughter out of the room so that they can have a conversation. And Alexander, being a doctor, turns to his niece and says, "The patient needs orange juice, stat." And what my thinking is, what do you always give somebody when they're sick? That, you know, you always think of vitamin C. Orange juice is an automatic go-to, at least for me when I'm not feeling well. So he's trying to give his niece some busy work to get her out of the room for a few minutes.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And it's really cool that you thought that deep into that scene to establish an unspoken motive.
Well, it's also extremely sugary. So I was trying to think of what's going to be a juice that if a kid just happens to spill it, because if I remember correctly, she's 4 or 5 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
So if she's got a full glass of this juice, what's going to just make a mess as she's walking back into the room?
Okay. So then again, you've got the opportunity for extra time to have this adult conversation.
Mm-hmm.
See, and my thing with this is, I think what people don't realize is it's the little things like this that are the hardest part of writing full novels and books and keeping your rhythm. Because coming up with an outline for a story is actually pretty easy, because that's what William and I do pretty much every episode. We do a very vague outline of a really cool idea. And that's not too bad. What's hard is, like, you know, what Justine has just been talking about, is finding the little filler to keep your story rolling and keep the rhythm, because those little things, I think, are what really holds you up at the keyboard. Like, what do they do next? I mean, do you find that to be true, Justina?
I find it to be true more so when I've actually outlined, because I tend to be more of a pantser by nature. So as long as I haven't come up with the plan ahead of time, beyond having scenes kind of floating around in my head, it keeps me far more engaged in what I'm doing. So I find myself actually sitting and staring at the screen less.
Okay, that was going to be one of my questions for you. And just for our listeners, I'm going to kind of explain something. So when Justina said pantser, she's referring to the old term flying by the seat of your pants, as in you're just making it up kind of on the spot without a plan. And that was what I wanted to ask you is, you know, do you prefer to outline everything, or are you more of a pantser? And I think you just answered that, but that's really cool. And I also think pantsing is way more fun. And I've experienced exactly the same thing. I have more freedom to let the story tell me what to do, as opposed to me having to follow this outline I've set up.
Do you find writing in that manner that you end up in editing the novel or story that you've done to be more cumbersome or more time consuming because there's so much fluff that you need to cut out?
Actually, quite the opposite. Because for me, because I did plot out several of my books last year because of the insanity, which I'm sure we'll get to eventually. But I found that in BioLife specifically, let's just talk about that book specifically, I ended up with 15 to 20 scenes that did not actually make it into the final book because once I sat down and started writing and started looking at the time I had available and all of these sort of things, I started really paying attention to, okay, is this scene necessary? Is it not? And I pulled, as I said, 15 to 20 scenes that I'm going to have in later books that just would have lengthened the book, but they wouldn't have necessarily been good or bad. So when I'm just flying by the seat of my pants, as you said, I can only see so far in front of me. So I can only see from the scene that I'm on to the next scene. And that actually keeps me from going on a ton of tangents because I know where the end point is. So it's literally just putting one foot in front of the other as you're walking down a path. And you keep yourself from going on a lot of side quests, and at least my brain does.
Totally agree with that, 100%.
Doing that, Justina, what you just mentioned is that you can see the scene that you're on and maybe the next scene, and you know where the end point is. Do you find that writing in this manner gives you better insight into your character's emotions and feelings at the moment? Can you identify with the character better as opposed to having a skeletalized plot that you're trying to put the flesh onto?
So for me, I actually, the first step that I do for, I'm going to say 90% of my books, is I actually write out an outline of the characters. So I do like gender, height, weight, eye color, so I don't trip myself up with those details later.
Fair.
Yeah, the first book I ever did, I had changed one character's eye color 5 times before my editor caught it. So yes, I always make sure I write down those details, but I also write down key points of their backstory. Like for my main character, Darlene, one of my main characters, Darlene, in BioLife, I write down things like the fact that she had a fiance and that he was killed, and specific details about his death and all that kind of stuff. So anything that could have really emotionally shaped a character in the past, those are the things that I try to have written down already. And there are so many times that as I am going through a book, I will find a new scene and then I get so excited because I see the threads that have been laid that I didn't necessarily realize that I was laying. And that's the moment for me that I just start getting so, so excited about a story, when I start to see all of the little strings and different things that I can really start pulling for the twist or whatever it is that I'm working toward.
Give us a little bit of insight into the main character of BioLife, some of that backstory.
So there are actually 3 main characters of BioLife. There is Darlene Jones, who is a computer programmer. There is Jameson Hughes, who is in retail. And then there is his brother, Dr. Alexander Hughes, who is in science and medicine. And I can't give away too much about their details without really kind of compromising the mystery of the story.
Yes. So, no spoilers. Let's have our listeners support you by running out to Amazon and picking this up on Kindle or paperback. Do you have a hardcover?
I don't, unfortunately. My publisher, with the way they have things set up, hardbacks have to be 60,000 words or more, and this one fell short of that. However, if I ever put all 2 or 3 books together, it may end up being a hardback down the road. Okay, so Darlene Jones, Alexander Hughes, and Jameson Hughes. What would you like to know about them?
The blurb on the back is you've got your the mystery of not realizing how you got there.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's part of the story that we are to read and discover. But what emotions are going through your main characters during this time period?
During that time period, because of certain things that have happened, they have one thought that they need to get to safety. So there's a certain amount of fear, but there's a strange numbness in their system that they can't place. So they're aware that they should be scared. They're aware that there are a lot of natural human emotions that should be coursing through their bodies at this point, but they don't feel them. And that in and of itself scares them.
That's very captivating, because one of my favorite songs is Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. And it's a story, you know, about exactly that, comfortably numb, where you're numb to a lot of the surroundings and everything that's going on in your life, while recognizing that maybe you should have some form of emotion or response that you abnormally do not experience. So I like that setting and kind of the way that you described it. The question then that pops into my head is, did you find that challenging to write?
When I write, I'm very much the type of person, I love the Emotion Thesaurus, which is a fantastic tool for authors. It's basically a book that if you look up, you know, anger, sadness, whatever emotion you're looking for, it'll give you a ton of physical sensations you can write, or it'll give you different facial cues. It gives you all different ways to show that emotion through your character without saying he was sad, he was scared, he was insert emotion.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that. That's interesting.
There's the Emotion Thesaurus, the Good Trait Thesaurus, the Bad Trait Thesaurus, all of these books, and there are a few more even that I don't have. They're all excellent, excellent tools, but the Emotion Thesaurus is probably the one that I lean harder on than any of them. And I found myself going to say he did this or she did this or da da da, and I'm like, wait, time out. They're saying they should feel that, but they're not feeling that. So let's mute that. Let's muffle that. Mm. So instead of her frowning, she's looking off and she's studying the wall and she's going, okay, there should be, it's a lot of characters noticing the absence of something.
This all goes into the concept of showing rather than telling.
Absolutely.
So you're probably developing. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No.
Go.
Is that something you really wanted to say, or were you just kind of helping us fill the air? Because I don't want to cut you off.
I was going to say that I took some writing courses, and I was really bad about showing versus telling at first. And they pretty much hammered that out of me.
Okay, interesting. No, I was just wondering. I mean, you're really getting a rhythm here with your fiction. So to me, fiction is more difficult in the sense, as opposed to nonfiction, because to me, with nonfiction, you have the clay right in front of you, because you're taking something that exists and you're just kind of paraphrasing it, giving your opinion on it, you know. But with fiction, you know, you're making the clay and then you're molding it. So you're doing more work to me with fiction than nonfiction. So it's really impressive how much of an output you have in terms of novels. And like, what is your, like, your rhythm, like how many novels are you getting out a year right now?
On average, I do 5 to 7. That's what, like, wow. Anywhere from 3 to 7 had been my norm. Last year, I put out 11 between novellas and novels. It was a mix. But this year, I'm aiming for 3. Because last year, there were a few months where I even had double deadlines. Mm-hmm. Because there were some projects that I signed up for that were multi-publishers. It was my publisher, plus other publishers were all involved in this series. And I didn't realize that the due date, because of that, was different. My publisher normally requires a due date of 2 months before publication date. These were 3 months before publication date. And because of that, I had a couple months where I had double deadlines. That was the most insane thing, which is why I ended up with 11 books last year. And I'm trying to be a bit kinder to my brain.
Yeah.
This year.
That is hard on your brain. We're getting to do what we love, which is great, but there is a takeaway. It does stress the brain. And I don't think people realize how much information you're cramming in there, and your memory does suffer a little bit.
My sister, when I got done with last year, I was talking to a writer friend of mine, and she was asking how many words that I wrote in that year. And so I went through and I actually took all of my final drafts and everything and put them together. And it ended up being over 440 some thousand.
Wow.
That was before editing, because I wanted to see what my brain had actually put out. And my sister turned to me and she said, well, it's got to be emptier in your head now. I said, not in the least.
Oh, that's funny. Putting out so much material last year, you know, between novellas and books, including BioLife, did you suffer at all from writer's block?
Okay, so for me, when I make a promise, I keep it. And so those deadlines meant a lot to me. And I think if I hadn't made those promises to my publisher, I probably would have run into a lot more writer's block, because my brain wanted to shut down. I was at the level of exhaustion from my dad's brain bleed and all these kinds of things that I don't think I had ever experienced before. But because I made those promises, I wasn't going to allow myself to shut down. So I got to a place where I realized that rather than making my brain work with me, which is usually when I find myself in a writer's block, I had to work with my brain. So if I didn't want to look at a computer, okay, I had to find another way to get the words out, whether that was longhand or dictation. And dictation ended up being my best friend because, as you can tell, I can speak very quickly.
You know, so just, that was, I just want to say, Justina, you know who I want you to have a talking to with?
No.
George R. R. Martin. You tell him you finished The Winds of Winter. Already. I did it. I met my deadlines. You need to meet yours. That's like been, what, 10 years now?
I mean, honestly, life happens. Things happen. I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. But for me, ever since I was little, promises have been such a thing to me. And it's no wonder my name means justice or just. So to me, when you make a promise, you keep it.
Yeah.
And so I leaned really heavily on dictation and then laughed my butt off playing Mad Gab with my book.
Okay. All right. Dive into that. I'm really curious about that one.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so a lot of authors, when they dictate, they're very good and very smart about it. And, you know, they say new paragraph, all that kind of stuff. I do not. I speak the way I'm speaking to you. I go back and forth with characters, and it just ends up being a wall of text. And there was a line specifically from my book, A Time to Kill. And yes, I realize the title. This has been brought up before. I forgot that it was a big deal until after the contract had been signed. And then I went to my publisher and I said, is this going to be a problem? She's like, no, titles aren't something that can be copywritten. And I think it fits the book really well. So let's just go with it. I was like, okay. I was working on that book, and that was 1 month where I had a double deadline. It was A Time to Kill and Excess with a Cheesecake Swirl. It was those two books, same deadline. And so I am dictating and going and going and going, trying to get it all out. And there is a character in A Time to Kill that is a private investigator. And he has a brother, and he's talking to another character. And she asks him a question. What dictation got was UPI CPI2. And it was literally just letters and numbers. And I'm like, when did R2-D2 show up in my novel and why? I'm like, oh, this took a turn. And I'm sitting here and I'm going, and I'm just mad gabbing it. UPI, CPI2, UPI. I'm like saying it because I'm like, okay, it got what I said. It didn't get what I meant. It got what I said. UPI, CPI2. I'm like, CPI2. Is he a PI2? You're a PI. Is your brother a PI2?
Okay. Oh, okay. I get it now.
I could say that let's see here, back in 2012, 2013, so a decade or so ago, I had got the software Dragonspeak or whatever it was. It's the dictation.
I have that too. It's good.
And this was kind of when they had just released it. It was the premiere of the time. It was like $80 or maybe $120 to get the license or whatever. And I attempted to use it, and it was a complete frustrating experience for me. I just could not get the thing to actually, you know, work the way that I wanted to. And so I haven't tried dictation since, but I'm interested in doing it now, especially with the advances that we've had with AI and machine learning and other algorithmic text, as well as processing of voice. And one of the audio softwares that I use for the podcast is capable of actually taking the audio, putting it on the timeline of when you spoke a particular word, and now their audio is searchable by text, which is really cool.
Whoa. What I was going to say was, anybody who's wanting to dictate, I actually don't use any kind of special software. I use the Notes app on my phone and voice to text on that, because it doesn't require Wi-Fi. So if your Wi-Fi goes out, you're not sitting here and yammering to yourself with your phone taking nothing.
I was wondering how your response rate would be with the dictation, you know, from voice to text. And you say you're using your phone app. Do you find that, like, after 30 seconds, you have to stop and wait for it to process and then you continue to speak? Or is it more fluid for you?
I found that it was doing that a lot on my computer, which was so frustrating, and because I'm speaking and I'm letting go of the thought as soon as I say it, because I'm trying to continue on with the story, get it out, and I can buff and mold and all that kind of stuff later. And so I looked at my laptop, and I had been speaking for a good 20 or 30 seconds, which is 200 to 300 words. Not 20, 30 seconds, but 2 to 3 minutes, and it was 200 to 300 words. And my laptop had stopped.
Oh, that's horrible.
And
that's
know it. And I'm like, no. And I think at this point, it must have been 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I'm already tired. I'm already wanting to tap out. And it had just quit. And I'm like, yeah, nope. So that's when I started. I looked at Wi-Fi booster. I looked at all kinds of stuff. The best option ended up being the Notes app on my phone, because it doesn't require Wi-Fi. Everything that it needs is contained within the phone.
That's pretty cool.
Yes, I found that out, and I was the happiest I had been in a while when I found that out.
You find dictation from your previous years being a tool that you often relied on because of the massive amount of work that was upon you. This year, you're planning on three works. Do you intend to use dictation as a primary tool for your writing this year, or do you think you might be going back more to your traditional keyboard?
So last year, and this was actually something that we talked about a little bit, I guess backstage, you could say, last year taught me a lot about how to work with my brain. So, and I'm still going by that. If I am not wanting to look at my laptop, I don't look at my laptop. I will longhand or dictate it, whatever feels more comfortable that day. So whether it's scribbling it out in a notebook or dictation, I'm good with that. If I want to sit at my laptop and work, then I'll do that. But it really is about where my comfort level is that day.
So literally, you are a panster, not just in how you write your novels, but also the material that you do put into your novels in the methodology that actually gets written down from both a physical as well as a mental point.
I am now. I used to be extremely... I'm a perfectionist by nature. I used to be extremely rigid. But after becoming a caretaker for my father, and even with that split 50-50 between my mother and I, there's a level of emotion and a level of work and that kind of thing that I don't think I can really explain. People who've been in the situation will understand. People who haven't, I'll say it's insanity and leave it at that. Because, you know, there's emotion, there's thought, there's therapy, there's all this kind of stuff that goes into it. And then you have writing, which is emotion and thought and mental process and all this kind of stuff. So it really just, I didn't have the option of being a stare at one sentence for 5 hours perfectionist like I had before. There are things called weed words, which I believe most writers will, should, or do know about. It's basically words like, as, is, was, were, little, above, below, like all those kinds of things. Words that pop up in your writing like weeds. I was such a perfectionist before last year that I would go over my books ad nauseum until each page in the book was below a certain percentage that I deemed appropriate of those weed words. And it was that sort of perfectionism that if you're enjoying a book and you're reading it and you like it, you're not going to notice a ton of stuff like that. But because of the fact that I had been told these words are lazy, you're a bad author if you use these, blah, 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 I had been told that. So I would sit there and obsess, not over the story itself, but over the verbiage of, am I using these, quote, lazy words? Now, do you still want to get some of those words out of your book? Absolutely. They are the easy way out. But I am no longer the perfectionist that I was with that. Do I still give absolutely everything I have to each of my books? 100%. Am I sitting there and obsessing over them like I did before? Absolutely not.
Well, I think some of the best and first advice I ever got as a writer was to look for word repetition. And I think you just gave listeners that are potential or budding writers some great advice there to look for weed words and also, you know, be careful what words you repeat because people don't realize how many words get repeated in the text and you need to find mm-hmm. synonyms and things like that. And it's really important. So,
yeah, my editor is really good about that. Like I'll send something to her. And she's like, hey, sweetie, you've got this word is popping up a lot. You might want to go through. And it's something that I don't think a lot of authors know, especially if you're using a program like Word. It's really easy to just use the find mm-hmm. function to search for a certain word. And you can see if it's coming up multiple times on a page or every other page or, you know, something like that. So it's really easy to find, okay, just how repetitive am I being with these words? So it's easy and it's a pretty quick fix usually.
So something I wanted to ask you was, what is an author that, I don't want to say you try to emulate, but I mean, I'll be frank, I have authors that I try to emulate. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I mean, what authors inspire you? Or maybe I should say to our listeners, maybe what's a big author would you compare yourself to for our listeners as like a frame of reference? Like if you like their books, maybe you'll like my book, that sort of thing.
I honestly can't think of anything like that because I've never been, I read so much, but I don't necessarily pay attention to the author's name. And this is awful, but like I have them on my shelf. So if I ever think, oh, I really like that book, I wonder if there's any more by that author, then I'll go, you know, I'll go grab the book and I'm like, oh, this is the author. And I go look for more. But I started writing when I was 7 years old and I've been a writer all of my life. So I don't think that I've ever necessarily tried to write like a specific author or anything like that. Nor have I really sat here and compared my book to others. And I know that's probably the biggest cop-out answer you've ever heard.
No, that's an honest answer. I mean, that's all we want.
I can relate to that. Because one of the things that often gets brought up in some conversations that I'll have with friends or, you know, just general chit chat is movies and what actors or actresses that I enjoy, you know, their movies from. I don't have any in particular. I tend to have specific genres or tropes that I really enjoy. And from that perspective, I can talk about the movie itself or the type of films that fit within the same sort of category and cross-reference films, but I don't follow actors, actresses, or, you know, directors or musicians. There are very, very few that I actually do. But for the most part, it's kind of a panster idea as far as, you know, what Hollywood has outputted and what actually gets put up on my screen.
That's sort of the story of my life, because what movies I like changes with my mood, what music I like changes with my mood. So people are like, what's your favorite? I'm like, what day is it?
So going to that, from your output last year of the different works, the 11 that you produced, what was your favorite?
My favorite? Gosh, I'm going to say The Clockwork Killer, because some of the details that I put into that book, specifically for the serial killer, And the cover and everything about that book, I just really had a lot of fun. And that sounds awful, but...
That one stuck out to me when I was perusing your page. That was one I wanted to ask about, so I'm glad you brought it up.
That one, honestly, was so much fun. And I wish I could say exactly why it was so much fun, but...
So there's a backstory or a side story to that. Maybe we'll be able to coax it out of you in another episode.
Yeah, that was a story idea that I had started trying to work on when I was about 15, 16. And it did not, I think I got like a page into it and it wasn't working and I wasn't really having fun. So I was like, yeah, whatever. Set it aside. One night I'm laying in bed and I'm scrolling through my publisher's pre-made cover album. And I'm just scrolling through like, hey, is there anything in here that looks like fun? And I came across the full wrap cover for what ultimately ended up being The Clockwork Killer. And I see that image and I'm like, that fits. That fits somewhere. Where does it fit? And I'm staring at it and I'm like going through all the different ideas that I have in my head. And this little story idea that I had had when I was 15 pops back into my head. And I start kind of twisting a few elements around and adding a few things to it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's it. And I messaged my publisher real quick. I was like, can I call dibs on this cover? And she goes, yeah, sure. So I put a quick note on the cover to let everybody know that it had been grabbed. I typed up the blurb on my phone and the title and everything, and I went over it the next day and got it over to her, and then I had the cover, and that was one of the books that I had set in motion like a year or so before I became a caretaker.
I did not know that was a thing. That's a thing. Publishers will create covers for books that don't exist yet. Is that what I understood? And you caught it?
So sometimes. So my publisher being a small indie publishing house, she'll do a bunch of covers for various genres. And then she encourages authors to pick from that album. So she's not pulling more money from the budget to make covers for books.
That's fascinating. I had zero clue that is a thing, but that is a really interesting way to spur creativity. So my hat's off to him on that.
That's not the way everybody does it, but that is the way that my publisher does it.
And who is your publisher in this instance?
Crazy Ink.
Okay, cool.
Now, you had mentioned, John, that there was a couple other questions about this particular work that you were interested in asking.
Well, maybe not about the Clockwork Killer. Was it The Clockwork Killer? I'm sorry, but it's my bad memory.
You said Whiskey Haze, and you said you were also
okay. Yeah,
the Clockwork
but
Killer.
So Whiskey Haze. So this is something I've run into as an author. Now, since I write full time, I never have time to actually read for pleasure. But I actually do want to read Whiskey Haze just for pleasure, and that's probably going to shock some of our listeners. Because, you know, every episode, me and Will come up with these wild sci-fi plots with aliens and mythology. But when it comes to novels, what I like to read is just down-to-earth, like, human drama. And that looks like a really good drama because it's about a recovering alcoholic who inherits a bar from his father. And I think that's a fascinating concept. And I read the first few pages and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That one was fun for me. And it was a stretch and a way that I had to move my imagination and try to put myself into this person's shoes because I have actually never drank before.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you did. You must have talked to people who had drank because you had this line about it. It's like a warm, comforting blanket they can never go back to because he's talking about not being able to drink again. And that was a very good line.
So I talked to a friend of mine who has a lot of issues of that nature within their family, and I was kind of picking their brain, and I said certain things like, oh yeah, people, things that I should say, I regurgitated things that I had heard said to me, like, oh, people drink to forget, they drink to get away, blah, 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 blah. And my friend goes, no, anything you're feeling when you're drinking is going to be magnified like 20-fold. Like, so if you're sad when you start drinking, you're going to be bawling your eyes out. If you're mad when you start drinking, you're going to be breaking chairs. all that kind of stuff. So it even though, you know, the colloquial thing is that it numbs things, it does the polar opposite. So I was like, okay, how would that work for this character? This character, because of past things, he was a very sad person. He was angry. So what would that translate to when drinking? Now, what he may be doing and emoting versus what he's feeling internally, because I've also heard people talk about it, it's like a warmth and a fire in the belly. And so that's sort of what he's thinking of versus what he actually may have been doing during said drinking experience.
So it was also a stretch for you, though, too, because you're writing as a male character. And I wanted to ask you, did you write it as though you were portraying him or as though you were, let's say, an omniscient female narrator just looking into his head? How would you say you wrote that?
So for me, I don't really think about it because my dad was a stay-at-home dad and I'm an only child. So I was my dad's shadow. So I'm very much just comfortable and used to being around men. That's why in my author bio, I call myself a tomboy in high heels. I do all the girly stuff, the makeup, the heels, all this kind of stuff. But if you want to stick me in a garage with a bunch of tools and a car, I can work on that car, no problem. Like, I'm very used to talking to guys, being around guys, just because I was raised by a car guy. I know how my dad talks and thinks and all that kind of stuff. So I don't really think about, I'm writing a male character now. I'm writing a female character now. I more of think about, I'm writing a human being now.
Yeah. And one of my favorite authors is S.E. Hinton, wrote The Outsiders. And I had no clue, like a lot of kids, that S.E. Hinton was a woman writing as a man. Well, really more as a teenager, as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that just struck me as interesting as well. And so I feel like you're in a similar kind of like a no man's land with this Whiskey Haze book, because I think it's a book that would really appeal to a lot of men. But at the same time, men aren't usually big on reading dramas. They'll tend to read like either nonfiction or they'll read adventure books or sci-fi. I think it's a drama that would appeal to men. And then the cover is very nicely done, but I think a lot of men will look at that and misjudge it as well. That's a good looking guy on the cover. It looks more like a romance novel. I don't want to be seen reading that. Do you have any like conflicting feelings about how Whiskey Haze was kind of done up?
So I actually chose the cover for that book.
I think it's a good cover. I mean, you want to have a good-looking protagonist, you know? So, I mean, it is, like I said, it's kind of like no man's land, because, like, honestly, I think it would be an appealing book for guys.
Honestly, I don't think about that kind of thing. And that's one of the reasons where one of the places I probably trip myself up the most in marketing, because I come at it from, okay, this is the story. This is what happens during the story. That guy looks like the guy that I'm thinking about being the main character. There's all this mist around him, like the haze of the whiskey bottle. And I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And then my thought process stops there.
Yeah. But yeah, we probably kept you too long on this end. And we're hoping we'll get you on another episode if you're not too tired after this too.
Oh, absolutely. This has been a blast.
Okay, cool. Because, yeah, I feel like I kept you on Whiskey Haze for too long, but I just wanted to ask about it. And like I said, I hardly ever have time to read for pleasure, but that's one that I sincerely intend to read if I can find the time, because I really do think it looks like a great book.
Well, thank you. If you end up reading it, I hope you will enjoy.
Thank you.
So we have talked about BioLife in this episode with Justina Luther, who is on the phone, and John LeMay in studio here. Justina's books, BioLife, A Clockwork Killer, and Whiskey Haze, can all be found on Amazon.com as well as Justina.
They are all on Amazon. That's the easiest place to find them. Some of my books are wide available across multiple ebook publishers. Others are not. My publisher, unfortunately, has not given me that information, so I can't really tell unless I'm looking at my Amazon profile. Everything, easiest place to find it is on Amazon. You can also find it on www.authorjustinaluther.weebly.com. All of my books are there. It's an easy grab and go. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, BookBub, Goodreads, all the places.
Okay, so you've been listening to Plot Pit, where we have author, best-selling author, Justina Luther. Thank you for being on the show, Justina.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
And we are going to have you on our next episode, where we are going to dive into the pit again and come up with a creative fictional story. And for now, we thank you for listening, and you've been enjoying, hopefully, Plot Pit.